Texas Talking Owl. What was that that you said? Texas Talking Owl. Gonna hoop upside your head. Texas Talking.
Hello and welcome to the Tribcast. I'm Mark Halpern of Time Magazine. They say we should keep Austin weird. Doesn't seem to me it requires much effort. Here's your host, Reeve Hamilton.
Thank you. This is reporter Reeve Hamilton here with the Tribcast for the final week of November, and very little effort is what we will be putting into this one, I think.
Oh, my God.
Especially from editor-in-chief and CEO Evan Smith.
The tryptophan is waving over me right now.
You know, the tryptophan thing is like a total myth, right?
It is.
This is Reeve's mission, is to spread around the office.
He's a tryptophan truther?
Yes, he is.
Yeah, no, but the difference is, I mean, the word truther sort of often denotes something that people don't actually think, the majority don't think to be true, but the truth is that tryptophan is unlikely the cause of your need to nap after you eat turkey. Morgan Smith, reporter of the Texas Tribune, is also here.
Hello.
Do you believe in this?
I believe in science.
Oh, really?
No, that's a great foreshadowing.
Your scorecard grade is an F, I'm afraid.
And Ben Philpott of KUT and the Texas Tribune is also here.
Hello. I think it's the third piece of pecan pie that puts me to sleep. instead of the tryptophan.
Oh, where to begin? We now have our second topic.
Yeah, let's move on to our next topic. Which is, we talked about this a lot on the last podcast, but since then, Leticia Vanderpoot has officially gotten into the lieutenant governor's race. Morgan, you were there. Did it change everything?
Well, I think we saw a Democratic candidate who was very certain of the message that she wanted to deliver, and part of that message was, Mama ain't happy.
That was very Ann Richards of her. I actually thought the way she said that was something. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and it was an entertaining, kind of lighthearted speech that also touched on a lot of deeper issues. I mean, Senator Vanderpoot talked about some of the personal tragedy that she's had. She talked about the importance of family in her life. But then she also delivered on some of the substance and talked about how the Republican Party that has controlled Texas has forgotten about mainstream Texas voters, have lost track of their priorities because they're just so afraid of their Republican primary voters. And I think that's something that ties nicely into the current Republican primary for lieutenant governor. And so I think we'll probably look forward to more attacks of that sort from Vanderpoot as we find out in March, probably after March, in a runoff, who her Republican opponent is going to be.
You're not a believer that somebody can put this away on primary day?
I mean, it could happen. I mean, anything could happen. But if you have four candidates running against each
truther.
Other.
She's a runoff truther.
The motto of this podcast
I believe
is
anything
can happen.
Ben was at lunch talking about how Leticia Vanderpoot can sort of be the Joe Biden of this race.
I've heard from someone, and I honestly don't remember if this person was a Republican or a Democrat, but
or just in your head.
I'm pretty sure they were not in my head, but they did say that they thought Leticia Vanderpoot could be kind of the Joe Biden of this race, meaning that she might be more likely to go off script or say things maybe a little, what some people might consider a little awkwardly and a little forcefully.
Curse words?
More colorfully.
There you go.
But I think there's no script. I think that's the great thing for her, is that she's going to say what she wants to say. I mean, she's never exactly been on script anyway.
Or one to be shy of. I mean, you know, one of my favorite moments of hers in the Texas legislature is when she got up and offered the more sex amendment to the gay marriage amendment, saying Republicans were pushing the gay marriage amendment as this is something that will save traditional marriage. And she said, you want to save traditional marriage? Force the couples to have more sex. And so she offered it straight-faced, no smile, as an amendment to this bill back, when was it, 2005?
And it's great. I mean, this is something that's coming from the mother of six, a grandmother who is the mother of six children. And it's, you know, it's just kind of that contrast, I think, is part of the appeal that Vanderpoot can probably offer.
To be fair, AG candidate, Republican AG candidate Barry Smitherman has made the same proposal.
Did he call it the same thing?
No, but he's just encouraged couples to procreate as much as possible.
Well, Joel Osteen does the same thing, so it's not exactly.
What's he running for?
Maybe governor one day. Who knows?
I think Vanderpoot versus Dan Patrick. Not that I'm making any predictions about this, but as far as a general election race goes, if you're going to have Van Depute versus Dan Patrick, that'd be a fun one, Morgan.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And a fun one to watch.
Well, let's we also learned since the last podcast that there is at least one Democratic state senator that will not be running statewide this cycle, and that's Carlos Uresti, who decided not to run for Texas Attorney General.
It really does look like it's going to be Davis and Van Depute and not a whole lot below them. I mean, Mike Collier is, you know, seems like a solid enough guy.
Right.
You have this Sam Houston guy who I'm, you know, not particularly aware of the the details of him, except he has that name, which makes me think he's not serious, but everybody keeps saying he is serious.
Well, I think his parents gave him the name.
Well, it's like people have changed their name to like Dairy Queen or something. Yeah. It's like these
Dairy
gimmick.
Queen.
It's like a gimmick name. and then your friend Kinky, correct?
Who does have a Democratic challenger?
He might be the only Democrat with a challenger.
Who that?
It's well, his challenger in the race.
But who is it?
Yeah, it's a Democrat.
It's a great question.
Keep up. Come on.
Dang it.
So it's going to be just two. And look, the Alana Rocha had a piece on the Tribune and in the Times this weekend that talked about women as the strategy for Democrats next cycle. And, you know, sure. Why not? You got to have a strategy. Right. There have been years in which there seems not to have been any strategy. This is not a bad strategy. And they try to appeal to people who feel like they're not having their voices heard, as Senator Van Depute said on that night over the summer. And, you know, maybe there are votes out there that would not traditionally go Democratic that will.
No, it'll trickle down to Mike Collier.
No, but I actually think it's not a bad. It's if you're going to have a strategy, why not have that be the strategy? There's a lot out in the air, whether it's abortion or equal pay, that have women's hackles up at some places, and maybe they're going to get some people who wouldn't traditionally vote Democratic.
Well, and even if you look at it from the battleground Texas viewpoint of, I mean, you know, none of these people are running because they think they're just going to strengthen the party and then lose. I would assume, but. You know, the whole idea of battleground Texas trying to, you know, create more relationships and make inroads in different things. So you spend the entire 2014 cycle working on women and maybe the suburban women. And that's bound to put the party in a better position next time around.
Didn't Van Depute say on Saturday, Morgan, specifically, I'm not running to help the Democratic Party per se. I'm running to win.
Right. I mean, and I think as a candidate, that is kind of what you have to say.
I think it's the mindset you have to be,
right,
not just what you say.
To be taken seriously. But yeah, absolutely. And Van Depute certainly kind of hammered Republican leadership on areas that she said they had, you know, not been helpful to women, including, you know, she didn't mention the word abortion, but she talked about defunding women's health care. And she said that if she's elected governor, that women would never be treated the way that they've been treated under the current governor.
So we have people running in all the seats on the Democratic side, and they seem to have something resembling a strategy, which is more than maybe they could have expected 2 years ago. Is that fair?
Yes.
All right. Let's move on to non-political topic.
What you have are serious candidates for governor and lieutenant governor. You know, Ross was attempting to tell me last week this was not true, but I will assert in his absence again that this is a very competitive ticket relative to past tickets.
Well, but what
governor and lieutenant governor candidates both are big brand names. It's not somebody in and also well,
we,
ran.
We haven't had that since 2002 in terms
of
the top two.
In 2002, they had. But it went in 2002. It went deeper than just the top two.
Yes, it did.
They had a
as
full
far as
field.
A full ticket.
It did, but
it
we haven't had
ticket.
It at this deep
field, yeah.
since then.
But I, right. I
it's
would.
The, it's the deepest since 2002.
I would argue
really
that Davis and Van Depute present a more interesting, you know, leaving aside the question of competitiveness. I think it's a more interesting ticket for the Democrats to have in place than Sanchez and Sharp, because Sanchez was really an unknown to a lot of people.
Well, so are Davis and Van Depute, but. I mean, I think any ticket
Van Depute may be more unknown than Davis.
Any ticket that hasn't yet lost is more interesting than one that already has.
That's right.
I'm not sure that Chris Bell and Maria Luisa Alvarado were interesting to anybody. Win, lose, didn't make a difference.
We'll go back and find the Tribcast from that primary season.
Oh, great.
All right, well, let's get into some actual substance and leave the horse
as opposed
races
to
behind.
This conversation, right?
Yeah. We also had quite lengthy. I don't know if it felt lengthy to you, Morgan. It felt lengthy to me.
She was tweeting. it was like a hostage thing. Please get me out of here.
Yes.
I haven't even said what I'm talking about yet. Last week's Tribcast is what I'm talking about.
She and I know.
Yeah. No, the State Board of Education, which people may have heard of, they met last week. For how many days?
They met
17.
They met Tuesday to Friday, and on Wednesday and Thursday, those meetings ended at about midnight. And they heard lots of testimony on a variety of things. Their responsibilities were approving the state's biology textbooks and environmental studies textbooks, and then also doing a substantial amount of rulemaking on a law that passed during the last legislative session that changed high school graduation requirements. So there was quite a lot for the state board to do. And then they also had to approve charter school or decide whether they would veto charter school applications. So there was a lot of news that came out of the meeting last week, I think. And one of the most significant pieces of that was what the board decided to do with these high school graduation plans.
And this is really, do kids have to take Algebra 2 or not? I mean, that's really the sort of the pivot point, right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's what brought Dan Patrick and Jimmy Don Acock in late at night for their cameo appearances.
Missing plane flights and everything, I hear.
Yes, at least in the case of Dan Patrick, who's campaigning for lieutenant governor. So Algebra 2 was by far the most controversial element of these graduation plans. And it's, you know, whether the state would require Algebra 2 for most students who, or for students who graduate on all of these different plans, was the big fight during the legislative session. It seemed to have been settled in favor of not requiring Algebra 2 for all students, only students that graduated on kind of a science and math focused plan. But when it came back around to the State Board of Education, the people who had opposed that, which included, you know, groups like the Austin Chamber of Commerce, MALDEF, they kind of renewed their lobbying efforts. And so when it came time for the State Board to determine kind of the details of this law, it had been thought that Algebra 2 would kind of come back as a requirement for all students. But as Reeve said, the two education chairmen of the legislature kind of made a last-minute appearance at the state board and told them that, listen, this is not what the legislature intended when we passed the law, and you need to respect that.
The argument here was about rigor.
That's right. And I think the concern of people who want Algebra 2 to be included in all the plans is that, you know, if we have these graduation plans for students that are perceived to be not as hard, then our low achieving students and our students who are considered to be, you know, more difficult to educate are going to be funneled into those plans, and we are essentially going to be creating a track for the college bound kids and a track for kids who aren't going to college. And there's equity concerns in that.
I think there's been, you know, there seems to have been a lot of concern about the whole idea of, well, you know, look, we're not going to do Algebra 2, but we are going to allow these, you know, more skill based or career based math type classes to be inserted there. But then nobody's really listed out what all those are. And I know that some of the, you know, the Chamber of Commerce people and stuff that have been very opposed to this have come in and said, well, you know, well, tell us what you're talking about. If Algebra 2 is not going to be required, what is this mythical, you know, other math course or other math courses that you're talking about? And we don't have that yet.
Yeah, and I think that's some of the frustration that came up at the State Board of Education was, okay, we're spending all of our time arguing about whether or not to require Algebra 2, yet we haven't spent any time talking about what other math courses, you know, students might take in its place, or even, you know, not even looking at math or science requirements, looking at career and technology courses, other things of that nature. We haven't looked at approving any other courses that this law was supposed to, you know, create and allow school districts to have more choices and to be more flexible with.
Do you think Acock and Patrick being there changed the outcome?
I think it did, honestly. I think that, you know, we had the state board and the TEA came out with these proposed rules back a couple months ago, I think at the end of September, that had Algebra 2 as a requirement for all the plans. And I think at that point, they started getting letters from lawmakers and kind of all the people that had testified against including Algebra 2 throughout the legislative session. They started getting letters, but I think seeing that, you know, seeing the two chairmen of the education committees show up to the meeting and tell them straight up that they would be going against legislative intent, I think did make an impact on board members. And you saw them reference that later when they had the vote. They talked about how, you know, this is what the legislature charged us to do, and this is a vote that reflects that.
How did the school board, the state board of education, pardon me, acquit itself? This is the post Don McElroy. You know, it's a different state board of education than we had a couple of years ago, the last time there was a big flurry of activity like this.
It is. So in addition to all the Algebra 2 and graduation requirement stuff, we did approve science textbooks.
Can I go back a second just to the Algebra 2 thing? One thing I was wondering about is, and this might be sort of third rail-ish, but, you know, is there a racial element to this debate? You had someone testified, you know, this whole concept that we're overeducating our students and preparing them too much for college, and that not everyone needs that is not coming from the African American and Latino communities. It's sort of coming from the Dan Patricks and Jimmy Don Acocks and the thinking, I think, that a lot of people assume that sort of the wealthier school districts will go ahead and implement Algebra 2 requirements and the ones with fewer resources won't, which could have an effect on, you know, different ethnic groups.
Right. And you have seen the organizations that advocate for Latino students and for low-income students. You have seen them come out against this precisely because of that concern that, yes, okay, let's leave it to school district decision, but we all know how inequitable school districts are funded in the state and how students' academic opportunities already vary from school district to school district. So if it's going to be left up to the school districts, that's probably going to end up that the school districts that serve majority low-income students might not be requiring Algebra 2 in all of their graduation plans.
And is it the case that, students had a choice before? What the Texas Higher Education Commissioner always says is that the genius of the previous plan is that the college prep curriculum was an opt-out, and now it's become sort of an opt-in. And that's his big concern. And also, I mean, you see, there was a lot of talk about this. I went to this higher ed coordinating board meeting last week, and they were talking about I think you're going to see a big push to get colleges more involved in the advising process for students just because they think that this new setup is so complicated and sort of contrived that it's going to require a lot of direction.
Yeah, I mean, to kind of present the other side of that, so before we had the recommended plan, which had, you know, the same requirements for all students, including Algebra 2, and then we had a minimum plan that a student could, if they, you know, for whatever reason, couldn't complete the recommended plan, they would opt into this minimum plan. And so the argument in favor of not requiring Algebra 2 under this new law is that, okay, so now students are basically students who graduate under the minimum plan, which is about 25%. 20 to 25% of Texas students, they're not getting any kind of skills. They're not going into the workforce ready to take a job. We're basically crowding them to the side, as Chairman Eric Acock said, without any real skills. And then that's not even adding, whatever you want to call the dropout rate of students that aren't even graduating under either of the plans. So the idea behind this is just to give more skills, opportunities for more skills to those students who aren't going to be going under the recommended plan in the current system.
All right, now you can talk about science.
The end result of this meeting was we had all biology books except for two and one environmental science book. We had three textbooks coming out of this that were approved on a contingency basis they're going to be reconsidered once a panel of experts deals with errors that were brought up in the environmental studies book on its treatment of fracking. And this was
errors or errors in quotes?
I think at this point, errors in quotes, because these are errors, at least in the case of the environmental studies, that were not even identified by the State Board of Education's own panel of experts and have been responded to by the publisher, but the board was persuaded by the testimony of a Railroad Commission candidate who came and testified on Wednesday night to the board and raised a lot of doubts about how fair this book was being in its treatment of fracking and other depictions of the oil and gas industry.
But isn't this absurd, though? That, I mean, they've had all this time to review this book, and they found like a couple of minor errors that were sort of non-substantial. And then someone can come in the last 15 minutes and say, oh, I don't think this is friendly to the oil and gas industry. And they can be like, whoa, time out.
Yeah, and that was, I mean, state board members definitely brought that point up. They're saying, listen, we've had, you know, this really calls into question our own review process. If we've had, you know, a 3-month-long review of this textbook that we would have ended up voting to approve had this one person not come and testified.
Well, it doesn't call into question their review process. It calls into question their testimony and decision-making process, you know. Give them the benefit of the doubt that their 3-month process may have been right and they made a bad decision to listen to this one person testifying at the last minute.
Right. And then, but then the response to that is, well, isn't this the whole point of having public testimony in the first place so that members of the public can come and we can listen to them?
Is there any way that this doesn't seem like a complete circus, a farce? The whole thing seems like a farce.
Well, and if you look at the publishers, is it Houghton Mifflin?
Mm-hmm.
Their response to this person, I forget their name.
Becky Berger is the name of the Railway Commission.
The response to her critiques, that, like, sort of line by line, are pretty hysterical, actually. I mean, some of them, they're like, actually, okay, good point. We need more updated information. Some of this is out of date. But then it'll be like, this textbook says that the oil and gas industry is evil. And they just say, we cannot respond to this overgeneralization.
And interested listeners can find this on the Texas Tribune website.
TexasTribune.org.
TexasTribune.org. We've uploaded the document. So, yeah, that was the environmental studies. That's going to be settled in January.
Can you come back to the larger question? Did this State Board of Education, this composition of the State Board, show a better judgment or do better in terms of the brand of the SBOE than the last one did during the last fight over these textbooks where it was a national embarrassment?
Yeah, I mean, I think no question. We don't have, you know, national, international news outlets descending on the SBOE to, like, you know, transmit these crazy, Texas is crazy sound bites, you know, all over the world. But I think that's been the case, you know, with the SBOE since for, you know, the past several meetings where we just, I mean, it's just an entirely different dynamic where you still see some of kind of the old issues bubble up, but they're not, the social conservatives on the board just don't have the control that they used to when they did it in 2010.
Barbara Cargill, who's the new current chair, is no Don McElroy in that respect.
No, she's not.
And they did end up vetoing one charter school, I think, just surprising some people.
They did. Right. They did. So this has also been the first charter school application cycle since a new law passed in 2013 that moved most of the authority to approving charter schools to the commissioner instead of the state board, but kind of gave them this, I think it was really like a compromise to say, oh, well, you know, we're going to be in charge of the approving, but y'all can still veto them if you want. And I think not a lot of people who were involved in passing the law thought that the state board might actually go against the commissioner's wishes on this, and they did. They vetoed one of the 4 applications that the commissioner had previously approved.
And what do you take from that?
Are they just showing that they can?
He's also an Algebra 2 Universal supporter, right? Seems like he's not.
Yeah.
They're not listening to him on a lot of things.
You know, I think it was probably important because this was something that state board members lobbied against the charter school bill, at least this part of the charter school bill, because they were very upset that their power over this was taken, and they take it very seriously. And I think that, you know, I think there were separate issues with this charter school application that had raised questions. It's a charter school that has it's been denied. It's out of Arizona, but its expansion into Nashville has been denied. And there are other issues, but I think probably for state board members, it was important to show that, yes, they do still have power over this, even if it has been put into a much narrower role than it in the past.
All right. Let's talk about just other goings on, specifically with State Representative Drew Darby. Evan, you want to fill us in on how he's spending his Thanksgiving?
Well, I don't know how. I assume he's eating turkey in San Angelo. What do you know that I don't know?
Pecan pie.
So or you think it's pecan pie?
Pecan pie.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So you're going to have as many pieces as you? Probably not.
Probably not. It's not crazy.
Drew Darby, state representative from San Angelo, I gather on the 14th of November was traveling back, maybe back home or someplace from Austin, but in any case forgot that he had a weapon in his bag.
A gun specifically.
A gun.
Not like a mace, a scythe.
Switchblade.
Nunchucks. He had nunchucks in his bag. The upside of this has been that, he's embarrassed, I guess, his office, and they've talked about it and said, you know, he's sorry, he forgot that the gun was in his bag. He's a concealed handgun licensee. But what I think is interesting is the right is attacking him for making gun owners look bad, that his forgetfulness somehow reflects badly on gun owners.
Well, Michael Quinn Sullivan over at Empower Texans in particular did a pretty scathing blog about it.
Yeah, I mean,
that's interesting because you'd think that this could, almost turn into like a rallying cry.
I was expecting the opposite, don't you think?
Well, and they're attacking him for creating a rallying cry for the anti-gun folks, but that side actually hasn't sort of come to the table yet.
Well, that's because the issue is effectively decided already. You know, you've got a candidate for governor, Greg Abbott, calling for concealed carry on college campuses with the approval of the regents and calling for open carry. There seems to be actually a stampede toward open carry. I mean, it's not as if the issue is gaining momentum on the gun control side.
No, is he calling? I didn't realize the approval of the regents clause.
If I'm reading Jay Root's story correctly today, Edgar Walter's story today in the Tribune, I understand that the concealed carry on campus requires the regents.
Well, that's a nice loophole.
Yeah, what's great about that is that is the status quo. So that's not much of like a...
The open carry is different, but yeah.
Oh, open carry is totally different. Yeah.
Well, open carry is kind of the...
Well, and that's just of a handgun. I mean, now you can open carry a shotgun or a rifle or whatever you want. It's just...
That's right. Would just be open carry. This would be able to get a six gun and a holster and, slap it on your side. Yeehaw.
If your order is late at Dirty's, just saying.
But not through, you can't do that past the TSA. That's not a...
Well, no, but I guess I'm just talking more generally about the mood right now on this issue. The mood right now on this issue is not anti-gun. It's, 100 state representatives could get stopped by the TSA at the airport with guns in their bags accidentally. And I don't think that the mood of the state would shift one bit on this issue. It is, generally speaking, an issue that has been decided. The state is pro-Second Amendment. The state is pro-gun rights. And
beyond
all the Drew Darbys in the world aren't going to change that.
Beyond having his mugshot plastered everywhere, is this going to hurt Drew Darby in the long run?
Well, only in this – no.
Couple court fees.
Shorthand, no. Short-term, no.
I asked about the long-term.
But I think – Darby is the issue that Darby and others have is that there is a rift in the Republican Party. We know this, and anything that is an opening for one end of the party to attack the other end of the party, that end is going to take. And so, what Michael Quinn Sullivan and his side has said on this is, he's made this look bad for the pro-gun side, but also he's one of the people who they're talking about to be the head of the Appropriations Committee, a guy who forgets that he had his gun in his bag, .. How do you trust this guy? And it's like,
so whether
entirely
it's
sure those things are related,
whether it's voting for the budget or forgetting about
like
your
he's
gun,
got a tax bill in his bag,
they're gonna come after you no matter what.
It's this still, as Evan was just saying, this goes straight to the idea of the two-party system, Republicans and other Republicans, and Democrats aren't picking up on any of this. I mean, I guess Michael Quinn Sullivan was screaming and yelling about how it's giving ammunition to the other side, but Evan said, what other side of the desk?
Yuck. Right. What Darby, he forgot something in his bag. I mean,
it's happened to the Dallas Cowboy coaches.
You're not much of a conspiracy theorist, are
you? It happened to Ted Nugent's wife.
Well, that can happen to anyone.
Shemaine Nugent? She also had a gun in her bag?
Yes.
Through
the airport. Oh, it was a news item.
Us magazine?
It is The View. We have turned into The View. That's exactly right.
Well, so as to not risk turning any more into The View, or having Evan Smith do his Joy Behar impression.
Oh, no.
Oh, there it goes. I'd like to encourage you to send your questions and comments to tribcast@texastribune.org. And we'd like to thank Shiny Ribs for doing our music. And on behalf of Morgan, Ben, Evan, and our producer, Todd, this is Reeve. Happy Thanksgiving.
I don't know what there is. Is there other things to talk about?
People want to talk about what they're thankful for?
We've turned into The View.